the farmers that make the most money are probably doing the most damage to climate, nature, and people. And the farmers that make the least money are the farmers who are basically farming the way we do. And the reason is because the costs and benefits of different farming systems are not either monetized or properly attributed. And as a result of that, you know, cheap milk is really costing the earth, or cheap anything, you know, industrially produced is costing the earth, but the price doesn't get factored into what you pay. And putting that right would be called true cost accounting. Just incorporate the true costs and benefits of food production into the pricing. And in the absence of that, we're still struggling and we need to break through. So it needs to be more affordable to buy proper food, real food from real organic systems, and more expensive to buy food which is causing harm. And the science and the art and the politics of putting that right would be what I think we need to work on.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots, farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label to distinguish organic crops that are grown in healthy soils and organic livestock that are raised on well-managed pasture. You just heard from Patrick Holden, a longtime member and trustee of the Soil Association, founded by Lady Eve Balfour. He is also the co-founder of the UK's Sustainable Food Trust, and he's a farmer in his own right. His family just celebrated their 50th year working the land on their organic dairy in Wales. Patrick is a kindred spirit, and he's focused on the best ways to reimagine and reinstitute a food system that truly rewards the people that are stewarding the land and their communities. So we have a lot in common.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. Today is going to be just a little bit different. I'm going to have a conversation with Patrick Holden of the Sustainable Food Trust in England. And so I'm going to introduce myself a little more thoroughly. I'm Dave Chapman, because some of Patrick's people will be listening to this as well. And I've been an organic farmer for 41 some years. And one of my very first teachers, Patrick, was Elliot Coleman, who I know is an old friend of yours. And he just lived down the road, and I was very fortunate as a young man to encounter him at a gas station, and we became friends, quite good friends. I've been a mixed vegetable farmer, and now I grow tomatoes in a greenhouse in the soil. I have to say that now, because in America, a lot of the certified organic tomatoes are hydroponic. And I also am a co-founder of the Real Organic Project, which we can talk about what that means. And so, Patrick, now let me have you introduce yourself.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast. I've been looking forward to speaking with you, because I think it's so important that we share our stories, because we are joined at the hip and we go back a long way. I'm Patrick Holden. I'm an organic dairy farmer and cheese producer from West Wales. And we just celebrated 50 years on our farm last July. And we had a big party to celebrate. And it's wonderful that you mentioned Elliot, because he is a good friend and arguably the elder of the organic horticultural movement in the USA. Just down the road from me, 8 miles down the road, is a man called Peter Seger, who was also a friend of Elliot's, who invited Elliot to speak at a very early conference at Cirencester of the organic movement. I think it might have been 1981 or 1982. So we go back a long way. And I look forward to having this discussion with you. I'm also the founder and chief executive of the Sustainable Food Trust. But before that, I worked for maybe just over 20 years at the Soil Association, during which time I was involved with others in developing the organic standards and the marketplace in the UK.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about. Let me start to create a little context. You came from a you grew up in the city, you came from an urban background, and you were part of a back to the land movement. Could you talk about when you went to Wales, why you did that, and did organic even exist in your mind at that point?
Yes, it's hard to remember exactly how the word organic came into my vocabulary, but interestingly enough, the first farm I worked on in my life was, although I'd been on some farms as a child, and I'll come back to that in a sec, was in Hampshire. It was an intensive dairy farm. The man running it was a man called Harry Hann. And I remember the first day I arrived, because I answered an advertisement in a local newspaper, help wanted on dairy farm. And he said, what are you interested in? And I said, organic farming. And the year was 1971. And I had come back fresh from California because my dad, I grew up in London, my dad was a doctor and then a child psychiatrist, and he was posted out to Palo Alto, to Stanford, where he was a visiting professor during the years 1970 and 71. And that took me to Palo Alto, and then I spent the best part of a year in the San Francisco Bay Area at an amazing time. How lucky I was to be there. And I came under lots of influences, and really that was, I think, a seminal moment in my development. So that I came back to England in the late summer of 1971, convinced that I wanted to get back to the land and set up a rural community which would lift self-sufficiency off the land and all those kind of ideas which were prevalent at that time. The Greening of America, a book by Charles Reich, was a huge influence on me, and just everybody else I met at that time. But before then, I just had an urban childhood. But because my parents had a love of wild places, I had been on holidays in Cornwall and Devon and then Scotland. And then in 1966, my parents bought a ruined croft on the Isle of Skye. So I would say that if I was to sort of think back at all the influences on me during my childhood, it was glimpses of nature and kind of ecosystems. And so it was a love of nature and being touched by nature that took me into farming via San Francisco.
Yeah. So, of course, that was such a different time. And it was my time, too. I graduated high school in 71. And it was in America, it was a time of phenomenal change. I think it was really the Vietnam War was the engine that drove that change. But a lot of things were changing. A lot of new ideas were being asked. And we're still trying to work those ideas out. And I'm curious, when you went back to think of organic, what did that mean to you?
What did it mean? I think it really meant farming, although I wouldn't have used these words then, but it meant farming in harmony with nature and avoiding chemicals. And I remember when I got back to England and looking around the countryside and seeing all these kind of lurid shades of green and blue, bluish green, which were the result of nitrogen fertilizer on the crops which were growing in the fields of the south of England. And I had this very strong reaction against it. And I thought, this is an artificial landscape which has been colored by chemicals. And because organic farming, I think the word was coined by a man called Lord Northbourne, who wrote a book called Land and Spirit, a wonderful book, actually. And then, of course, there were lots of other people who took the word on and developed it. Lady Balfour, I'm sure, will speak about some of these people. And then on your side of the water, Rodale and the Rodale Institute and others. But in a way, and there's probably a long conversation to have about why we alighted on the word organic, because certainly in the UK, during the early 80s, we had a big debate about whether we should call organic farming, even though the word was already around and had been for some time. And we said, should it be biological? Or then if you look in Europe, ecological, because if you look at Germany, France, and Denmark, and Scandinavian countries, those words are the words that are used to describe it, not organic. Even though, of course, all those people speak English and use the word organic farming. So it's fascinating how we alighted on that. But that's my recollection of it. And in a way, that matters because I think the word was coining a philosophy and a set of principles and their practical application in agriculture, which is what really motivated me much more than organic farming. It was this idea of farming in harmony with nature, of aligning thyself with those kind of natural ecosystems of which I now realize I am absolutely part. And I think I did already know that because music was a big influence on me. There were lots of, you know, musicians at that time. Neil Young comes to mind after the Gold Rush. Look at Mother Nature on the Run in the 1970s. But there were many more bands and musicians who were interested in this kind of thing. And that touched me very deeply. So it's music and love of nature, which took me into farming. And when you have a love of nature and ecology, when you apply that mentality and approach into farming, of course you come up with a system of farming, which we've called organic farming.
Yeah. So one of the things that seemed to be part of organic farming is it was a response to a growing chemical farming. And, you know, I think that's more. I grew up on a dairy farm in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'm trying to remember, were we using herbicides? And I just can't remember. I mean, no. I know we're, they were. I know we were using. Go ahead.
I don't think so, because they didn't come into common use until, I think, the 80s. As far as I can remember, pesticides were used, but they were sort of crude ones in the early days, horrible ones like the ones that Rachel Carson wrote about. But they weren't herbicides. They came later. And certainly in the UK, I could say that although pesticides were used probably from the end of the Second World War onwards, of course, that's a story in its own right, they weren't widely used until, I would say, the end of the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah. We were a fairly, what now would be extremely idyllic dairy farm. You've talked about the story that we imbibe about what a farm is. Well, we actually were that farm. I mean, it was cows going out to pasture every day for, you know, over half the year and rotating the pastures. It wasn't the kind of, I would say, high skill pastures that have evolved. You know, it wasn't that mob grazing rotational. You know, the cows are on there for 2 days and then they're off, or they're on there for 6 hours and then they're off. It wasn't like that, but it was quite beautiful, you know, and we grew a great deal of the cow's feed on the farm, and there was no confinement. In the winter, they were in the barn. So it's interesting, you know, that was so recent. That was my childhood, that was the norm for, dairy farming in America, and of course, chicken farming and vegetable farming and all of that.
Well,
so things have changed.
Because we come from the same time. That's my experience too. When we first moved to West Wales in the summer of 73, normal farming was exactly as you describe. Small family dairy farms, very small. There were thousands of them, and they all were selling their milk in churns still. This is in the early 70s, and bulk tanks, which are now everywhere, didn't really come in Wales until the mid-70s. So we were taking our milk down to the bottom of the farm lane every day in churns, and when we got to 10, that meant 100 gallons, UK gallons. That was really a moment. And there's a wonderful book of photographs called The Recent Past, which is actually photographs of farmers in North Devon in the 60s and the early 70s. And it's so evocative. And it was quite literally the recent past. And yet how things have changed during our farming lifetimes, it's incredible. And it's easy to forget that. It's easy to forget how recently all this stuff changed so dramatically. And it's still changing.
And there's a story being told that we'll all starve to death if we don't follow that change, which I don't think is true. We weren't starving to death back then. So why did that change happen?
Well, I mean, I'm just repeating a narrative which maybe is mostly true, but perhaps I'm just copying it, as it were. The Second World War caused food insecurity because the German U-boats were sinking all the convoys coming across from your place to ours. And so everybody was worried about feeding themselves. And of course, there was a lot of hunger. People had to change their diets. And ironically, people were very fed themselves very well during the Second World War because they changed their diets and they had more raw and unprocessed food and probably a better balance of diets, not so much highly Western processed foods and more natural foods. But at the end of the war, fertilizers using the Haber-Bosch process had been created in factories, and the opportunity to use those factories to create nitrogen fertilizer came along. And in the UK, we had a thing called the 1947 Agricultural Act, which was the response to food shortages, which said we had to grow two blades of grass where one grew before. And so the government subsidized crops, grain crops, milk, commodity crops. So farmers had the chemistry to increase their yields. And then, of course, later, as we just discussed, pesticides, herbicides and fungicides became available to suppress the pests, diseases and weeds, which were the inevitable consequence of agricultural intensification and long runs of arable crops. So the whole thing was a government-sponsored response to food insecurity during the Second World War, and also a belief that technology could solve the problems of the past, which had been were portrayed as farmers liberating themselves from the tyranny of work on the land and, you know, developing technologies which could make our food production more efficient. Is that your story?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have the U-boats, I don't know that there was food insecurity that was widespread in the U.S., but it certainly seemed like there was a belief that it was a smarter way to go and a more profitable way to grow. And I don't think there was much consciousness of consequences, health consequences, climate consequences. I just think that was not part of the conversation when I was young.
Well, I read a statistic just the other day that if you look at the degree of food self-sufficiency of different countries all over the world, the US still is a net surplus producer of food. So I guess that was never in your narrative, food insecurity, because you always had boundless acres of land where extractive farming could not only feed your population, but also be a source of income from exports.
Yes, for until the music stops playing, right? Which, you know, we're seeing members of the band leaving. So we'll see what happens. Tell me, but before we go to this, tell me how you got involved with the Soil Association. In other words, you took it from your farm and a personal decision to join a movement. I think that's a very significant development.
Well, I come from a family of missionaries, so maybe there's something sort of epigenetic there. But I remember when I felt part of a movement which was a flowering of a change of consciousness. And I think many of us felt that during that time, the kind of Woodstock time and the Isle of Wight Festival time and the time of wonderful, amazing music and this feeling of a revolution of love and consciousness, which connected a whole generation of young people with a tremendous sense of idealism. I was absolutely intoxicated by that. And I felt this huge optimism that we could respond to what we already perceived then was the ecological crisis by getting back to the land and living more in harmony with nature. That was absolutely what took me in. And then once I got involved with that, I realized that there were organizations representing that movement. Although they came from a different time, they came from the Soil Association was set up by Lady Eve Balfour in 1946, just after the war. But I knew that there were some organic farmers already around who'd been practicing some time. So when I was learning my trade, as it were, after I worked on that dairy farm in Hampshire, I decided to study organic farming. And the only course that I could find at the time was a course in biodynamic agriculture at Emerson College in Sussex. So I attended that course, and when I was there, I met a man called David Stickland, who was connected with the Soil Association. He set up a separate organization after that, but he was editor of the Soil Association Quarterly Review, which was their magazine. And then I met the local group of the Soil Association, of course, because while I was at Emerson College studying biodynamic agriculture, I met lots of biodynamic farmers. So that those were all massive influences on me. And when the commune landed in West Wales in 73, we sought out like-minded fellow travellers, of whom there were quite a lot, because it was kind of Britain's California at that time. There was cheap land and, you know, you could be free. Very unlike California in terms of its weather, but the atmosphere was kind of similar. And so we decided to set up a group called the West Wales Soil Association. And we got into campaigns. We stopped a long sea sewage outfall going out from Aberystwyth. We started tree planting, all that kind of stuff. And that led me to becoming involved on a voluntary basis with the Soil Association. And then stand for council, which I did in 1981. I didn't get elected the first time. Then I stood again the next year and got onto the council. And that heralded in a new chapter of my life, which was initially working on a voluntary basis for the organic organizations. And then later, from about 1988 onwards, in a paid capacity, because I was also involved with setting up two organizations representing organic farmers and growers, namely the Organic Growers Association and British Organic Farmers. So I joined the existing organizations and then created new ones and then became fairly centrally involved with the Soil Association from the end of the 80s onwards.
So you got to know Lady Eve, I believe. Is that correct?
I did. And there was what has been described as a coup. The group of us who got elected onto the Soil Association were all pretty young at that time, in our 30s, even some in our 20s. We had the audacity to believe that it was important to put organic principles into practice and develop a separate market for organic foods. And the people who were the disciples and colleagues of Lady Eve at that time on the council were aging, and they were totally committed to the philosophy, but they didn't really think that organic farming should be commercialized, because they saw that as a danger in terms of diluting the philosophy and the principles. So when we came along and said, yeah, we've got to set up a market because we can't make it farming in an organic way when we're competing against people who are having subsidies of chemicals and guaranteed prices. So really the need to develop the organic standards came, I'm speaking personally, but I know this is a shared view, from maybe about 100 organic farmers and growers in the early 80s who said, well, look, we need to define a system of farming which is addressing all the needs, farming more sustainably in harmony with nature, write that down more or less on the back of an envelope at the time, and then take our story, because it was a storytelling exercise, to through the media, because they fell in love with us at that time, to the market and develop a story which people would buy into by paying a premium for foods produced in that way. So it was a kind of market and set of standards and a system born out of necessity, which then developed as it did.
I want to, you know, put a bookmark on what you just said, because I think it's a very important conflict or coming together. And I will say that I think both sides were right. I think that Lady Eve Camp was right, that when as you bring this into commerce, it's going to get buffeted by those forces and twisted. And if you don't bring it into commerce, it's never going to scale. And, you know, we have to find some way to grow this food in a way that people can make a living doing it. And or it will be very small indeed. It will, you know, essentially be estates and home gardens. And nothing wrong with that. My best friend when I was a kid, his mother was an organic gardener. She read Rodale's magazine and she had delicious food from the garden that we ate every night at dinner. I ate there a lot. And so that's a real thing. But in order to take this and change the landscape, we have to take it to a commercial system of some kind. And so I agree with that. So you went on, you became the director of the Soil Association. Did I get that right, Patrick?
Yeah.
And you also famously wrote the first organic standards for cattle, for dairy farms, right?
Yeah, I joined the Organic Livestock Standards Committee as part of the standards development exercise, which was hosted by the Soil Association. And we were just a bunch of young people, young Turks, the people who were, as it were, ousted by us, we were known as. I never answered your question about Lady Eve. I did know Lady Eve. And she was, by this time, in her 80s. And I think slightly confused by what was going on with all of us young Turks, because she liked us. And her friend and colleague, Mary Langman, who became a very close friend of mine, who worked with Eve throughout her life, she basically told Eve that we were okay, we were good people. And yet all Lady Eve's friends and disciples on the council were saying, no, these people are dangerous because they're just going to commercialize things. But of course, our interest was born out of our idealism. It was never a desire to make money. It was more of a survival thing than a money-making thing. But I don't think everyone understood that at that time. So back into the, and I did, so I did not only know Lady Eve, I went to see her when she was in very late life, and then I spoke at her memorial service. So I had a great affection for her, and I think she was a remarkable and amazing woman. And by the way, the man who was responsible for taking the organic standards into the UK government, a man called John Gummer, who has now been ennobled and is called Lord Deben, he also spoke at Lady Eve's memorial service. And he was at the Oxford Real Farming Conference, which I've just got back from. He's now an organic farmer. So he was the Minister of Agriculture who decided that the government needed to take on the organic standards. And unlike your story on your side of the pond, that minister totally gets all the things that you and I, the principles that you and I share, which is rather fascinating. He's now left Parliament. And he was chair of the UK Climate Change Committee, and he was interviewed the other day in Oxford, and basically was saying all the things that we would say, which is rather interesting. But I think you're right that when a set of principles and a philosophy is commercialized, there are attendant risks. So we were on the Livestock Standards Committee. Somebody said, well, you're an organic dairy farmer, whatever that means. And at that time, nobody even thought about organic livestock standards. You're doing it. You might as well write the standards down. So that's literally what we did. And the standards then formed the Soil Association Livestock Standards. Then John Gummer and the UK government took them in-house in 1987. And then in 1992, the EU organic regulation followed. And then when did the National Organic Programme start? That was a bit later, wasn't it? 94, something like that?
I think it got started at 21, 22, something like that. So it's been around for about 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So
by the time it got around, I mean, we already had our own organizations with our own organic standards, but long before that.
Oh, I know that.
And
I met, when I came back, to the IFOAM conference in Santa Cruz in 1986 and met all the CCOF people, I know a lot about your organic standards development because I was working internationally as part of the Soil Association and have friends, organic friends all over the world.
And until very recently, almost all the organic standards around the world essentially agreed with each other. In other words, it's not that people were really having different definitions of organic until recently, until the USDA started to change.
Yeah.
And, twist the standards quite substantially. Now we have organic CAFOs of chickens, of cattle, dairy, large confinement operations being certified as organic. We have hydroponic berries, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers being certified as organic, things that would be unthinkable in the world standards, but only in the U.S. Unfortunately, the U.S. has such a large shadow. I'm not convinced that we'll remain only in the U.S. So that's the battle that is going on. So did you feel that your work at the Soil Association was successful? Was organic growing? Was it being real organic, in your opinion?
Yeah, I do. And I think that we created a movement, the organic movement, which came together every year at various conferences and events that we hosted, which created the most fantastic atmosphere. And there were a group of us who did that. And Peter Seger, who I've already mentioned, was one of those. And we organized around this annual conference, which took place at Cirencester, which brought together all the early pioneers of the organic system, the people of my generation. And the event was cultural, it was spiritual, it was a sharing of ideas. We partied all night. They were fantastic gatherings. And I think that the media, who told the stories that we were developing ourselves, came to trust us. And I think that the fact that the organic market grew quite rapidly, certainly when, you know, I was between, I guess, the beginning of the 90s and about 2008, when we had the big recession, there was double-digit growth every year. There was a huge amount of trust and optimism in the organic movement. And then the clouds started to gather on the horizon. We can talk about those. But I don't think the dilution problem that you are experiencing, have experienced for many years now, was as prevalent. And one of the reasons for that was that when we were threatened, as we would see it, with hydroponic production, we went to the UKROS, the United Kingdom Registered Organic Food Standards Committee, and we said, you cannot allow non-soil-based organic production. And we won the argument. And then because we'd won the argument in the UK, I think that sort of transferred into the EU, since we unfortunately Brexited, it's all been a bit different since then, but that's another story. But I think that we survived, and although there has been a dilution of standards in some areas, we could discuss that, I don't think that that was ever a real threat. But what I do think is that if you look at, and I've heard Michael Pollan say this, if you add the amount of organic production there is in the UK and all the local foods who might not be certified but are basically running along organic principles, you add them all up together, it's only tops 5% of the market. And now we know, because of climate change and the need to transform the whole of agriculture, that unless we find a message and a story and a transition pathway which eventually embraces all the farming community, we won't reverse the climate change and nature loss which is going on at the moment, not to mention the damage to public health and all the social impacts. So that was one of the reasons which took me to decide to leave the Soil Association. I wanted to work on a broader stage, not because I was abandoning the organic movement, and we're still farming organically and certified organic today. We're the longest established organic dairy farm in Wales, but because I could see that there was a problem, which to a degree was the result of what all the success in the organic movement, and we'd become seen as a separate part of agriculture, and I never really wanted to feel that.
Okay, good. We get into some complicated waters here. So, of course, the closest connection that I see is with the regenerative movement, which has got a very similar impulse. And regenerative is so ill-defined that it goes from everything from some small hippie farmer who says this is regenerative and it's completely organic to Bayer Monsanto, which says what we're doing is regenerative, and Bayer has a significantly bigger microphone. So I have a feeling that Bayer is going to win this conversation in the public because they control so much.
I really don't.
You don't think so?
No, this is contentious, but I mean, I think there's a deep friendship between us, so we can have this discussion. It's an important one.
Sure, sure.
So
I have complete respect for your point of view. So yes, have at.
So I mean, we're in this, aren't we? We're in this right now. So today, I've had two or three conversations about, you know, the amount of Roundup that's used in regenerative farming and how absurd that seems to probably you and me. Because if you are using a herbicide, the only way you can perpetuate a system is annual spray with Roundup, which is going to affect the soil microbiome. It's going to wipe out all the plants because that's what Roundup does. And it allows you to continue to grow long runs of arable crops without a fertility building phase in the rotation. That isn't going to deliver on climate change or nature restoration, and it's probably going to damage public health. I'm personally convinced that it is only a matter of time before Roundup will be banned, because I think it's going to be seen in the long term to be more dangerous than tobacco in terms of what it's done to the environment, damage it's done to the environment and public health. So I think we need to hold our nerve. And I think the question about the absence of a definition of regenerative agriculture is absolutely fascinating. And I know and deeply respect the campaign that you're fighting with the USDA and others, and that section of the farming community that want regenerative to mean something very different from how we would see it. But I do think that there might be a different way to address this. And this is what we've been working with the Sustainable Food Trust on for about 8 years now, namely to develop a framework where we can measure the sustainability impacts of all farming systems against climate, nature, and people. And that we've called it the global farm metric, but it doesn't matter what it's called. What matters is that you shed light and transparency on all farming systems, including organic, and you measure using the same harmonized framework. And I believe that if that happened, then the regen light farmers, the ones who are greenwashing, let's say, would be exposed by their incapacity to deliver on soil carbon, on biodiversity and positive social impacts. And I believe that that system, let's imagine you introduce that system in America and you have like a sustainability score of 100, which would be a composite of the climate, nature and social impacts measured in ways that we can all trust by auditors, certifiers that we can trust, including the organic certifiers, by the way, then I think that, for instance, we're producing cheese on my farm. If we had that audit on our farm today, we would score very highly on that sustainability scale. Whereas somebody who's practicing, you know, the other kind of regenerative farming using some chemicals and especially a lot of Roundup and no proper crop rotation, they wouldn't score very high. So I think that way we can maintain the organic market and have a sustainability score. And the ones that are diluted, the USDA kind of definition, which has been the result of very successful lobbying by those intensive farmers you mentioned, would not score highly. But I think what we've got is, apart from the organic certification labels, which have been degraded by what you've just described, there's a huge amount of confusion out there about what food you can trust. And I think the idea of a common, globally harmonized way of measuring sustainability might reconcile that and rebuild trust amongst consumers.
It's a beautiful idea. But I do feel that we are all bombarded with information every day, overwhelming. I have been just one sustainability metric that we've had to go through because we sell to Whole Foods and they've developed their own thing.
I know.
And you get ranked good, better, best, or excellent or something. We're excellent, wonderful. But nobody cares about it. I've talked to the people in the stores, and one guy in California said to me when I asked about it, he said, you know, you're the first person in 3 years who's asked me about this system. So it exists, but nobody really cares about it. And many, many systems like this seem to exist. So there's a thing about hitting a tipping point where suddenly people care. Right now, organic is still something that people care about.
Yeah.
One thing that's interesting to me, Patrick, you can help me with this. I think you said what percentage of food in England is certified as organic?
Well, I think you're probably between 2-3% right across the whole marketplace. There are some exceptions, right. Like, for instance, organic dairy, particularly yogurt, has a bigger market share, and milk as well, which is interesting and kind of slightly accidental, I think. Although maybe because of welfare issues and of concerns about hormones and things like that, the milk of human kindness, you know, it's complex. But basically, if you take right across the whole piece, it's probably not more than 5%, top max.
Yeah.
And is that, you know,
sorry. My understanding is that Denmark is at about 15%.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting.
For milk, they're at 50%.
Yeah. So why is that? I would say because two obvious reasons, and probably lots more. One is that the Danish word for organic is ecological. And connected to that, all the Danish conservation organizations, if you were to say to them, what's the best form of farming to benefit nature? They would say organic, of course, or ecological, of course. And if you compare that with the conservation organizations in the UK, RSPB, WWF, the Wildlife Trust, it's changing now, but for most of my farming lifetime, they've praised us in a faint way. They've said organic's very nice for a bunch of hippies that got back to the land, but mainstream farmers will have to continue to use chemicals. And why is that? It's complicated, probably because some of the trustees of the big conservation organizations were chemical farmers themselves. But the lack of support of the millions of people who were the members of those conservation organizations made it much more difficult for us to break through into the mainstream. And that is, I would say, still the case today. And there's a guy called Craig Sams, you might have heard of him. He founded Green and Black's Chocolate, and he launched the first Whole Food shop in London. And he once said to me, he was the chair of the Soil Association when I was there, he said, we'll know when we've won the argument when RSPB run an editorial in their Birds magazine saying RSPB, that stands for the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. If you want to protect farmland birds, buy organic food. That's the editorial headline, which we haven't yet achieved. But he was right.
Yeah.
And so, so we've had forces against us. And that's my point.
Yeah.
And then the other force which is against us is the lack of internalization of externalities, meaning that the polluter pays principle hasn't been applied. And farmers who are delivering public benefits in terms of climate change, avoiding climate change, or better still, actually sequestering carbon in their soils, or increasing biodiversity, or delivering better health, we haven't been rewarded for those positive public benefits from our systems. So using an inappropriate aeronautical analogy, it's as if those of us who are farming organically are against a headwind, an economic headwind, which is so powerful that it distorts and makes dishonest the price of the food that people buy. And they don't know all that stuff. So they see this enormous price gap between so-called normal food, conventional food, and organic food. And then that leads to charges of elitism and only for the few, and you know, it doesn't really deliver that much. And then we're up against all those other claims which some of the big companies are making.
Okay, the religion of cheap food. It's become Michael Pollan's very interesting about that.
Yeah.
That he sees it as a government policy in order to avoid the consequences of a declining standard of living, and that as wages have continued to be depressed through various government policies, actually, that cheap food is the antidote to social unrest. They keep the food very cheap. People are making money, but we, the taxpayer, are supporting it. So does that sound true to you? And I know that you talk a lot about true cost accounting, and I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Yes, I'm not really a great fan of conspiracies. Maybe it's just my naivety. But I think that however we got here, the fact that most food is dishonestly priced because it's produced in an extractive way, which is causing damage to nature, which hasn't been monetized, and it's causing massive damage to public health, but appears cheap. I think the reason why governments want to perpetuate that system is because they think that it would be electorally unpopular to do anything which puts the price of food up. And they may well be right, unless we, meaning you, your organizations and ours together, working together, can inform the public about the unbelievable damage that our industrial farming systems are doing to the climate and its people, to such an extent that it becomes an electoral issue. Are we there now? No, we are absolutely not. So, you know, we've got the Tories in the Last Chance Saloon right now, and likely a Labour government getting elected. But if you go to Sir Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, and you say, how important do you think regenerative farming, proper regenerative farming or organic food is to the future of your government, he'll say not very. And he's probably right, because if you did focus group stuff, that wouldn't be raised as an electoral priority. So I think that's our failure, our collective failure. I think we need to acknowledge that, and I think we can change that. I feel there's a time now which reminds me of when I was around, you know, in the 60s and the early 70s, when there was this huge feeling of a shift of consciousness going on. And I think the climate change threat, the nature threat, and all the food insecurity and health issues, I think they're coming together and they're creating enormous opportunity for us to work together in a new way now.
One of the speakers at our conference this year was a woman named Zephyr Teachout, and she wrote a book called Break 'Em Up. And it's a book about antitrust action, about basically until we break up these incredible concentrations of power, we actually will be unable to create the change that we want, that we all want.
I don't know her, but I love her for her campaigning work. But what I would say is that I think we haven't got time to fight the system to the point of its disintegration. I think they know that unless they change now, they're going to be Kodak. And I think we underestimate the humanity and the fear and the lack of knowledge about what to do from some of these leaders of the world's biggest food companies. Weirdly enough, I'm quite an orthodoxy challenger, and I don't sell out. I mean, I try to speak truth, and I'm definitely not being watered down in my feeling about how much things have to change. But because the then Prince of Wales launched at Davos at the World Economic Forum in 2020, a new initiative called the Sustainable Markets Initiative, I have got to know many of these CEOs who are running the biggest food companies in the world, et cetera, et cetera. I never thought I would meet them, but now I actually do know them. And what strikes me about them, I mean, we're talking everybody from through McDonald's and Nestle, Unilever, all these big food companies who absolutely are part of the problem at the moment for some of the reasons we've been discussing. But what strikes me about them is they've got kids. They know that their own customers don't trust them anymore, and they don't quite know what to do. And I think those that don't change, you know, quoting Dylan's songs, you've got to get out on the new road if you want to lend a hand, because the old road is rapidly aging. And I think they actually know that. And I don't think, and I think the king would, as he now is, would think this too. We haven't got time for the disruptive, small-scale CSA farmers market movement to completely replace those enormous food companies which predominate and are more or less in charge of all the food that's eaten today. I think we have to persuade them to go on a new journey. I'm not saying I don't believe in bottom-up action. I absolutely do. And, you know, our farming system is trying to do that. But I do think we need a top-down and bottom-up action. And I don't think you need to sell out just to talk to these people. So that's a difference.
That's wonderful. And I hope you succeed. I don't expect to be talking to those people myself.
Why not?
I'm troubled.
Why not? They need to hear your voice. Because you're right. You know, all the people that are part of your Real Organic project are right. And you've got some amazingly influential advocates and champions in your movement. And I think it's incredible. All I'm saying is that I think they actually are more open than one might think to listening to people like you now. I think it's difficult to do it with anger. That's all I would say. I think that we somehow have to digest our own righteous anger. It's a difficult thing to do.
I actually don't come to this with righteous anger. I don't feel that righteous. I think we're all part of a deeply flawed system, and some people are doing things a bit better, but it's very hard to change. I'm struck by you. Did you ever meet Emmanuel Faber?
No.
He was head of Danone.
No, I didn't meet him.
Yeah, he did an interesting thing. I mean, he's one of the most powerful speakers I've ever heard. And he was really trying to reinvent Danone and to have them become much more decentralized and localized in their food production his idea of decentralized would still look pretty central to me. But he's trying to move the company radically in that direction and to try and produce food that was more healthy.
Yeah.
And he got fired when they had a down quarter. And my point is that I'm not sure that these world leaders actually have the ability to create change because they're part of a system. And I know I'm not being very optimistic here, but I'm trying to understand where the points of inflection are, where the institutional acupuncture points are that we might create change. And I support the people who are working to try and change the CEOs. Good luck. But I don't know. I mean, clearly the whole gestalt has to change in order for those people to change, or they just get fired.
Yeah, and I think you're right so far. I think that the fact that he got fired was because there wasn't a sufficient counterforce to the maintenance of the status quo in terms of profits and market share that he had to look after. That was his first duty of the CEO. So his shareholders said, sorry, guys, you're not doing enough. We're not going to see our share price fall. You're out. And so you're right so far. I'm saying that just in even the last couple of years, things are changing. And I don't think, well, I certainly don't know, and maybe none of us know, what the transition journey of these megalithic food companies is between where they are now and where they need to be, because we don't even really know what the landscape of a relocalized, truly sustainable food system would look like in America or in the UK. But I think we need to go on that journey, and we need to co-create the food systems which need to replace the ones that we've got at the moment. And that includes the organic farming distribution systems. I mean, you know, Alice Waters is a great friend of mine. And, you know, I say to Alice, well, where do you get all the foods for Chez Panisse from? And she says, well, we've got the growers that we've been supporting right from the beginning. But if you look at some of the way in which the foods are distributed and taken into the system, I'm not saying that, I love Chez Panisse. It's probably the best restaurant in the world, you know, but I don't think any of us are free of the systems that, you know, we are part of, which distribute our food. And I don't know that they're going to survive the transition that's coming. I don't even really know exactly what the new ones are going to look like. And I think that is our responsibility to help create them. And if true cost accounting was applied globally, then the economics of long distance transportation of all the vegetables from California or Florida or wherever to every city in the US was applied, I don't think that would work anymore. So that's pretty interesting.
And so just for people who haven't spent much time with true cost accounting is saying, okay, you eat this cheap apple, but it makes you sick. And then we have to pay for the medical bill, not to mention that your life has been severely negatively impacted. But there's a medical cost to cover that. And part of the reason it made you sick is it was sprayed with something that went into the water and created illness for a lot of other people who never saw the apple. Is that a very simple description of true cost accounting?
Yeah. So at the moment, the farmers that make the most money are probably doing the most damage to climate, nature, and people. And the farmers that make the least money are the farmers who are basically farming the way we do. And why would that be the case? It's crazy. Because you'd think that the most ecologically produced food ought to be the most affordable, because that's not trashing the planet. And the reason is because the costs and benefits of different farming systems are not either monetized or properly attributed. And as a result of that, you know, cheap milk is really costing the earth, or cheap anything, you know, industrially produced is costing the earth, but the price doesn't get factored into what you pay. And putting that right would be called true cost accounting. It was a phrase actually coined by Christy Brown, who's from Louisville, Kentucky, and is on our board. And she just said, let's call it what it is. Let's call it out. True cost accounting. Just incorporate the true costs and benefits of food production into the pricing. And in the absence of that, we're still struggling. And we need to break through. So it needs to be more affordable to buy proper food, real food, from real organic systems, and more expensive to buy food which is causing harm. And the science and the art and the politics of putting that right would be what I think we need to work on.
Okay, so Patrick, in your mind, there are many ways to work on this. In your mind, is the highest leverage to work on a local food system, building the reality of how things should be, or is the highest leverage to work on reform in government and trying to change the system that completely supports this bad alternative?
I think both. We need to work top down, bottom up, and in the middle, and whichever our passion and our skill, that's what we need to do. And it's a holy struggle. You know, I think it really is to sort this out, because what's the future is, you know, a livable planet for those that follow us. And agriculture is in the front line, I think, of the battle with climate change and nature restoration. Unless we change agriculture, we will fail, because agriculture is the predominant land user on planet Earth. And I think that it's as use. I believe in the idea of microcosm and macrocosm. And if you see the food system as a giant organism, then the farms and the smallholder holdings are the cells. And in order to make an organism healthy, we need to start with cellular health. And I believe that if we restore our own and develop our own farming and food systems, however small they are, and make them healthy, we are contributing towards the change of the whole system. And I think that also operates with citizens who may not produce food, but who eat it. They are in microcosm the change that's needed. They just need scaling up. So I believe that informed citizens can be the change.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think it's daunting. I think it's daunting to create change. And it's interesting. Let me ask you this about Farm to Fork initiative in the EU. That's a radical and ambitious attempt by the European Parliament to set goals which might not be met, but their goal is to reduce the chemical inputs by 50% by the year 2030 in agriculture, and to increase the percentage of agricultural land that's certified as organic to 25% of the land. These are radical ambitions.
Brilliant.
Do you think that there's a prayer of approaching those goals?
Yeah, I do, actually. I mean, you'd mentioned Denmark and whatever it is, 20% and 50% in milk. I mean, that's cause for hope, isn't it? I think it is really all about citizen awareness. And I think the problem we've got is that so many people live in cities now and they have no connection, personal connection or knowledge of the story behind their food. So I think education at all levels is a part of the key, because an educated citizen can vote as well as eat differently. And, you know, we need to do that. And we have, what really strikes me, I mean, because of my California year, and because I've spent quite a lot of time in the US over the last, well, most of my adult life, I keep coming back. I believe that we are umbilically connected in this struggle. You know, we understand each other. We share a philosophy. We share quite a lot of the history, actually. And I think that even though I believe that the organic movement needs to kind of reach out and find a more inclusive way of working, I do believe that the system and the philosophy and the movement of which we are part is right at the core of what the change that's needed. So I just think I mean, this might be controversial, but when I speak in public meetings, which I do, I tend not to use the word organic, because I just think it might put up like a prejudice thing in, you know, people who are not organic farmers. Or so I try to talk about the issues. I say, look, you know, chemical farming is causing the destruction of biodiversity or causing climate change. And I think if you raise the issues and you've got some science to justify them, I think that's a more potent way of reaching people. And actually, what the conclusion that they would reach if they thought about it would be that organic farming and the principles of organic farming are an embodiment of the solution that we need to find. And therefore it will come to us. But I think if you try to be sort of missionary about it and ram it down people's throats, they sometimes have a negative reaction. And also people are very scared of change. And if you can say, I often say to conventional farmers, of course you're farming that way because it pays better. And you can see the kind of relief that they feel, because otherwise you just will, they feel attacked.
Yes. Yes. I agree. I believe that organic farming will work just fine in terms of creating change as long as it works economically.
Yeah.
And absolutely. When farmers see that they can make a living. Let me tell you a story about Vermont, the state that I live. And back around 2016, we saw a lot of farmers in the state converting to become organic farms and getting certified. And because quite simply, they could make a living at farming organically, and they could not make a living conventionally. They were too small. They were up against the CAFOs.
Yeah.
And then the CAFOs entered organic, and they could no longer make a living because it depressed the price. People were willing to pay the premium in order to get the real milk. They still thought they were getting the real milk, but they weren't anymore.
Yeah.
And we see those farmers going out of business. Recently, Horizon, which was owned by Danone, dropped all the farms in Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine that they contracted to get milk from, because it was more profitable to get the milk somewhere else.
I mean, so, honestly, you might think we don't know what you're talking about. We do. I mean, the same, they're dilute compared to the extremity that you describe, but we're feeling the heat as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that dilution not only makes it that the farmers can't make a living, but it means that the people aren't getting the food they want, and they start to lose confidence in organic because they read about it in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And so I think there's a whole downward spiral there, but I don't think that it's true that people won't change because it's odd or because it's called organic. That's true right now. If you go to Iowa or Kansas, there's a lot of animosity in the farm community towards organic. And it's seen as something that they only do on the coasts and a bunch of weirdo coastal people. But actually, if it was obvious to them that they could make a better living being organic, they would. And once they became organic, they would realize that it worked better and they're not getting sick from the pesticides and on and on.
I agree with all of that. I think the big barrier is economic. And I think in their hearts, most farmers would want to farm more in harmony with natural systems and nature if they could make a living so doing. I just think that the forces, you know, the tide's with us. And so we just need to hold our nerve and find a way to communicate with these people and make transparent the inadequacies of the system which is still predominating. And I think we can do that. I really do. And I just feel that we're on the edge of a big, big change. And I think the fact that the climate change movement have recognized that soil carbon sequestration could be part of the solution, and that we have to restore nature, and also finally people are realizing that we have a public health catastrophe. And these are all to do with, you know, hidden costs, which you, if you monetize them, of the present system. All those forces are with us. We just need to be able to articulate our story in a way which doesn't threaten the people who need to change. And I think there's some psychology in that.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. I actually don't come to this conversation with anger. I come to it with some anger towards the USDA for their failure.
I shouldn't have used the word anger. I should have used the word indignation. We're right to be indignant.
Yeah. And but how do we create change? It's very complicated. Well, one thing I see in storytelling is now people are get so many stories. It's very hard to figure out which stories you choose to believe.
Yeah. But I think people could recognize authenticity. And, you know, even though sometimes it feels as if, you know, other people have got messages which you know are greenwash, which seem to be playing out very widely. I think in the end, if you speak to your truth, people can sense it. So I think the fact your whole campaign is preventing I know it's not totally succeeded, and you know, obviously realize there are forces against you, but I mean, you're holding the candle up for real organic, and I respect you, and I think that the organic market will survive this transition. By the way, we haven't talked about that, but I think that you've got to have a kind of differentiation in the marketplace, and I think if we add a sustainability score, that will be the best guardian against greenwash and dilution. But I think the organic system and philosophy and food products do need to have a place in the marketplace to help the transition along.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've run our hour. There's lots more to talk about, but maybe we'll have a second conversation, Patrick. Do you have any last words that you'd like to end on?
I feel very moved to feel this very strong connection with your country and all your growers and farmers. We have a shared view of things. I just think it should be seen as a demand on us to work together. This is what we're speaking about is international, it's global. The principles unite us all. And so I do think that if we do work together and share what we can, I think we can come through this. I feel pretty optimistic as we enter.
Wonderful. I will stand close to you and hopefully absorb some of that optimism.
Well, thank you. Bless you for all you're doing and all the people that you've brought together.
And you too, Patrick. You've been working on this a long time. You know, you became activist much younger than me. I really was just farming and raising my kids for 20 years in there. And then I realized one day that things were kind of going off the tracks. And I hadn't seen it. I live in a part of the country, maybe like Wales, where I looked around, I said, I had my doubts about the USDA running organic, but I was wrong. It's growing and all the farms are really organic and this is actually working out pretty well. And then as we discovered that it wasn't working out so well in the rest of the country. And
but you know, it was much worse. I know this is perpetuating the conversation, but let's take Tom Vilsack, who's, you know, a politician to his fingernails. And I'm sure some people in, you know, who are part of your challenging movement probably have a kind of disparaging view about him. But in a way, he's just a politician, isn't he? He just wants to get re-elected. So he comes out with the sort of rhetoric that you'd expect him to come out with. And he's lobbied by God knows who. And he probably, you know, is vulnerable to that lobbying power. But we just had to be the bigger force. That's what I think. Politicians very rarely lead. They just want to get re-elected and they'll follow, not lead. So I think the leadership needs to come from ideas and impulses which go right back to the land. So I think our time is now, you know, because the people that have been left out of all this politics and this debate are practitioners. And it's the practitioners that have the wisdom and the practical knowledge of how to put this philosophy into action on the land and scale it. That's us.
It has to be a coalition with the people who eat the food too, or it will not succeed.
Of course. Yeah. You have a brilliant organic consumers movement, which is very powerful in America. More powerful than we don't have that here yet.
Yeah.
We have Soil Association, which has got a very small membership.
Yeah. Okay.
All right then.
Patrick Holton, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. Our movement is growing because you are subscribing and sharing these podcasts with your friends. So keep it up and leave us a rating and a review while you're at it as well. You can find a video version of this interview on our newly designed website, realorganicproject.org, or on our YouTube channel. And you can join us every Tuesday for a new episode featuring voices from the organic movement. See you next time.